would be if you were stopped with possessing drugs.
Yeah, so basically, rather than, you know, arresting somebody for possession, they would go in, you would get a Class E misdemeanor violation, which is like a $100 fine. You could get that fine reduced if you went to, you know, through like treatment programs and stuff, but it was, and you didn't actually have to legally actually even show up to court necessarily. So it's actually pretty lax law when it comes to drug possession, which is something that opponents like to focus on a lot. Proponents of the measure say that the treatment center is actually like the main piece of this legislation that, like you said, takes the cannabis tax dollars and pays for treatment centers all over the state.
So there's this 15-month hang time that we're going to talk about between when the drug decriminalization part of the measure happened and when the funding started going towards creating these services that were, like you're saying, a big part of the measure. Before we get into that, I want to talk about what has the funding from Measure 110 been able to accomplish so far?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to talk about in there because it's actually accomplished quite a bit. You know, voters passed this with 58% of the vote in 2020. That is at the end of, you know, a time of kind of racial justice protests where a lot of people in the public were thinking about racial disparities in policing. And that seems to have a large effect on, you know, the measure passing. 3 years have passed since then. And, you know, the public kind of views this, you know, differently now. But during this time, there is a report that's come out, a study that shows that Black Oregonians arrested for drug possession has decreased by 77% since the law took effect in 2021. Despite that, you know, 63% of Oregonians at this point support bringing back criminal penalties for drug possession. So the kind of short, you know, and or longer term memory there is lacking.
So for this article, you spoke to Max Williams from the Coalition to Fix and Improve Measure 110. What is their vision for the future of the measure?
Yeah, Max Williams wants to, and this coalition started working together this last summer. And in September, they put this initiative, filed paperwork to put this initiative on the ballot in 2024. He was the head of the Department of Corrections for a long time, for like 8 years. And he told me that Oregon never had a war on drugs because it never adopted mandatory minimum sentences. With that said, state police certainly did help to enforce federal drug laws at that time, and there are people still sitting in jail from that. But what they want to do is create harsher penalties. They kind of believe that people are not being compelled into treatment because the decriminalization aspect of Measure 110 is so lax, and they want to create harsher penalties, not felonies, but misdemeanors with larger fines, and kind of not allow people to get out of essentially the judicial system. And they kind of want to use the justice system to get people in there and then have ways for those records to be expunged if they finish treatment programs. So it kind of kicks things back into that system rather than doing what Measure 10 intended to do in the first place, which is to keep people out of that system.
So kind of off of that, right, since its implementation, Measure 110 has been blamed for a lot of what's ailing Oregon. But you write in this article that there have been multiple studies looking at what the impacts have actually been. And one of those was from NYU on overdose deaths. What did they find?
Yeah, that study said that decriminalization didn't impact overdose deaths at all. It's worth noting that overdose deaths in the United States are up, and they have been up since 2013. That's roughly the time that the billionaire Sackler family created the opioid crisis, which they are now paying billions of dollars for. That is a national trend, and Oregon actually sits below the national trend at the rate of overdose deaths. This study found that decriminalization actually did not contribute at all to a rise in overdose deaths, despite the fact that there is a rise in overdose deaths. It wasn't because of decriminalization. In fact, people are less likely to call for help if they overdose for fear of arrest, and criminalization may actually contribute even further to overdose deaths. So
the feeling being that decriminalization may actually lead to averting overdoses.
Right.
Well, another big sticking point for critics of Measure 110 is the crime rate, or more specifically, the violent crime rate. People kind of go between those. But what does the data say about that?
Essentially, it has reduced even violent crime arrests by, you know, this is like based off of 100,000 people, and it went from, off the top of my head, like 50.2 per 100,000 people to 40.8, I believe. And so it's actually reduced violent crime arrests. There is a significant outlier where Black people are disproportionately arrested, even still, to the point of it's something like 216 per 100,000 people, and roughly the same even still. So, you know, the study has shown that violent arrests actually have not increased. And as we know, this is sort of anecdotal, but even just kind of drug possession interaction with law enforcement can lead to more violent arrests. So it in fact reducing interactions with law enforcement can mean that people aren't becoming more violent and being arrested.
Well, Oregon is not the first place ever to decriminalize drugs. Portugal did it in 2001 and has been looked to as a model for treating addiction as a health issue rather than a criminal one. And I found it very interesting as to what Max Williams pointed out about what separates Oregon's context from Portugal's. Can you speak to that?
I also found that interesting. In that point of our conversation, yeah, I said, despite what people tried to sell us on with Measure 110, the United States is not Portugal. And I said, why? And he said, we don't have the same systems that they have. We don't have universal health care. We don't have affordable housing. He started to list off some of the things that actually, you know, kind of socialist policies that people who proponents of Measure 10 are trying to build in an effort to actually get people on this off of the streets. So, you know, one of the questions that we kind of raised here, is how much kind of investment in law enforcement, how much that money goes more and more to law enforcement, and whether or not those budgets could be used for something that, you know, that people like Max Williams are suggesting would lead to success.
What are some of the problems that advocates see in Max Williams and this coalition's attempt to revise, or as I believe someone from Health Justice Recovery Alliance put it, repeal Measure 110?
Yeah, I talked to somebody kind of off the record who essentially said that these ideas of kind of fixing and improving Measure 110 and not using the word repeal is sort of a bad faith argument. And that's a really difficult thing to try to approach as a journalist. You can't just come out and say this is a bad faith argument. But, you know, again, as ever, the racial disparities in interactions with law enforcement is a massive concern for people. And, you know, that trying to stand up more and more treatment centers and really give this thing some time to play out so that people, you know, aren't being negatively impacted by interactions with law enforcement is kind of the point of this measure in the first place.
There was another point in the article that addressed how the success of treatment is impacted by voluntarily being there or being forced to be there under penalty.
Yeah, this is a really interesting point. I talked to Shannon Jones at the Oregon Change Clinic, which is a culturally specific provider. That's something that Measure 110 called for, is for people to be culturally responsive. And, you know, she mentioned that when people are ready to go into treatment, you know, there's kind of one attitude there. And then when people are going into treatment just to avoid paying a fine or just to avoid jail time or whatever that may be, that can be not only not successful for that person to be in treatment when they don't want to be there, but it can also have adverse effects on the people who do want to be there. And so this kind of idea, you know, she was saying of compelling people into treatment through a law enforcement kind of justice system into spaces where people are, you know, really trying to do some work, you know, in those treatment centers could actually have a negative impact on the work that's, you know, the successes that people are already seeing.
I guess with that in mind, Measure 110 being a little over a year funded, what does treatment look like today?
Yeah, Shannon Jones, you know, I have one kind of story from the Oregon Change Clinic that I think represents a larger thing about how kind of deeply healthcare professionals think about what drug treatment is. And, you know, Shannon Jones told me that when she first started the clinic, people were sleeping in the parking lot and asking for, you know, just kind of hoping to get some help and hoping to get a meal when the clinic opened. And so one of the first things that she realized is that people not being housed was a barrier to housing. So they started renting hotel rooms around the city. And that actually created some issues too, because it wasn't necessarily sober living facilities. And so people would be, you know, trying to go through treatment program. And then that, you know, could be a trigger for people if they're seeing drug deals go down or seeing other people do drugs. So the Change Clinic rented a motel, leased a motel. Measure 110 funding helped them fund renovations at the motel so that people have a safe community there. They bought a van that can transport them to the clinic, which they go to for 16 to 18 hours a week. And at that clinic in a separate building, they have like acupuncture, yoga. They have like TMS, like magnetic stimulation for chronic depression. Just kind of a space where people are able to actually kind of care for themselves in sort of a, you know, a spiritual way, or in, you know, just in a corporeal kind of way. So there's a lot more to drug treatment than I think a lot of people consider, and that's what Measure 10 funding is helping people to do.
What are the takeaways that you hope readers and listeners get from this story?
Oh, it's a tough thing. Everybody, you know, that I talk to seems heavily invested in, you know, getting people into treatment if they want it. Something that came up a couple of times is the idea of safe use sites for drugs. A safe supply has proven to be effective in some other areas, and I'm not sure if anyone's ready for that conversation quite yet, but there are tools, you know, available. They're starting to happen right now. The next round of funding for Measure 110 funded sites is ongoing and will be there through, you know, funding places through 2025. So, you know, it's kind of a matter of do we tear the house down when we're, you know, halfway through building it or not.
Where can folks find a copy for themselves?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy it directly from a vendor. They accept cash, Venmo, and tips. And you can read online at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up here?
No, I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That was Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots talking with me about his cover story in this week's paper. It's called Measure 110 Shows Early Success Despite Backlash. Health experts say Oregon should stay the course on decriminalization and treatment. More information's online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
This is KBOO News In Depth. Civil rights advocates are warning of the dangers of suppressing pro-Palestinian speech in the midst of what some see as Israel's genocidal violence against the people of Gaza, after a major attack on Israel by Gaza's ruling party, Hamas. Aaron Kunani has written about the Israel-Palestine conflict for The Nation, The Guardian, The Washington Post, and The Intercept. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
So censorship of Palestinian views. How prevalent is that, do you think? And is it getting worse? Or has it gotten worse in the last couple of weeks?
It has been a major problem. And right now in the United States is, you know, the at least some of the major social media platforms having a very deliberate policy of censoring posts that are pro-Palestinian. There seems to be a particular problem with Facebook and Instagram owned by Meta. We're also seeing demands from employers that people lose their jobs if they are posting on social media in support of the rights of Palestinians. We've seen a law student at New York University lose her job offer already. That's the one case that we certainly know about. We've seen demands for students in Harvard University to be kind of blacklisted for potential jobs they might be applying for. So that's the picture in the United States. In Europe, the situation is actually even more striking in some ways. We have in Germany and France, any demonstration that supports the rights of the Palestinians has been banned. The Home Secretary in Britain has said that if you wear a Palestinian scarf or wave a Palestinian flag, that might be a criminal offense in itself.
This sounds almost kind of nutty. I mean, this is just seriously extreme. Have we seen anything like this before directed against any other group?
We've seen this in the past. The atmosphere in some ways is reminiscent of the early years of the war on terror. I mean, I think what it tells us is that defenders of Israel feel like they're losing the argument, right? They can't win the argument through open debate anymore and feel the need to use their ability to influence governments to pass legislation and take these kind of measures, using their power as employers and so on to censor instead of to try and win the argument through an open debate. And that's, you know, I think it's been striking actually after the kind of initial few days where the dominant message, I think, in the public debate in the United States was, you know, we stand with Israel and so on. In the last few days, I think the mood has shifted and more people are seeing that what we're looking at right now is the potential for what could well be a genocidal assault on Gaza, but certainly war crimes on a large scale committed by Israel. It's necessary for everyone to take a stand against that. And, you know, the arguments that are being mobilized to justify it from the Israeli side are transparently unconvincing.
There are Palestinian organizations in the U.S. and in European countries. There are organizations on college campuses. So as far as you know, has there been any attempt to crack down on the existence of those organizations?
Well,
is the thrust more to just make sure they're not too public about their support of Palestine?
Yes. So at this point, I think that the main burden is to use the control of social media, use the control of jobs and so on to impose an attempt to weaken one side in the debate, the Palestinian side in the debate. We have, though, seen, you know, FBI agents turn up at quite a few people's homes over the last few days in the United States, questioning people who are affiliated with the Palestinian cause, you know, civil activists in the United States. So again, that's reminiscent of that moment in the early period of the war on terror where, you know, huge numbers of Muslim Americans had that knock on the door from the FBI agent.
I guess some of the pro-Israel people are likening the Hamas attack to the 9/11 attack. Is that right?
Yeah, that's come from the Israeli side that, you know, that this is their 9/11. And I don't think that analogy really makes sense. Hamas is not Al-Qaeda, and the circumstances of the two moments are radically different in that sense. But where there is, I think, some similarity is, you know, if you remember after 9/11 in the United States, things moved very quickly to a new kind of set of norms about what the limits of acceptability were. So anyone in the days after 9/11 who tried to say there's another side to what 9/11 was about, and you know, even while we deplore what happened in those attacks, we can also at the same time talk about the historical conditions that created the situation where some people decided to carry out the 9/11 attacks, right? So you know, that broader conversation was shut down, and that, you know, that happened within a matter of days, in those first immediate period after 9/11. It was just impossible. Anyone who tried to sort of tell a different side to it was immediately denounced as an apologist for terrorism. And that then, you know, in those first couple of weeks, that then set the terms for the subsequent years. And then, you know, those of us who were opposed to the Afghanistan war and to the Iraq war were always kind of fighting from the back foot, as it were, to try and to make those arguments, because, you know, a particular way of thinking had already been established as the only acceptable story. Now, they have tried to do that this week. They've tried to say that anyone who wants to talk about a context or a history to Hamas's attacks last week is somehow complicit with terrorism and so on. But actually, this time it hasn't worked so well. I think
they are talking about the suffering that is happening in Gaza. You know, all the people being killed and wounded and having to flee. So there is that part that's getting covered.
Absolutely, that's right. And I think that wasn't the case a week ago, and that's being forced on to the agenda by the large numbers of people, even in the United States, who wanted those issues raised, right? And I think to some extent we've done a good job over the last 10, 15 years or so to be able to kind of get a little bit closer to, you know, to a kind of level playing field in terms of the competing narratives on this issue. And so, you know, that's given us the ability to have a line where we can now say the context for what's happening, the unavoidable context for what's happening, is a military occupation carried out by Israel. And as, you know, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz pointed out, therefore, whatever happens in this conflict, there is an immediate responsibility on the perpetrators of violence, but there's also a responsibility on Israel itself as the military occupying power. And therefore, you know, this is not a battle of good versus evil. This is not a battle of, you know, Israel as a representative of Western values against the barbarism of the Palestinians. That's not the story here. And I think more and more people understand that. You know, this is a story of a colonial project, a military occupation, an apartheid system, and people trying to fight back against that in ways that sometimes we might find deplorable, but nevertheless, the power relationship here is one of a colonial project and an apartheid project.
Now, there have been pro-Palestinian demonstrations across the country. I know probably in some countries they've been banned, but here you do see them, and there does seem to be some political space to operate here. You even see some, occasional sympathetic coverage in the media.
It's few and far between, isn't it? But you know, I mean, I think the dominant picture in the media is still very much, you know, on the pro-Israeli side. And we had, if you've been watching CNN, then it's incredibly centered on the notion of Israel as the victim.
It seems like, you know, there's a real free speech issue here. And could Palestinian groups take the issue to court if their free speech is being suppressed?
I mean, I think there's certainly going to be possible legal avenues for people who, you know, have been offered a job, as we've been hearing about, people who've been offered a job and then express an opinion in support of Palestine and find that job is rescinded. You know, that job offer is rescinded. In those kind of circumstances, it seems like there would be some kind of possible legal remedy. You know, I think we're seeing in academia directives coming from university management telling academics, you know, that they're not allowed to post things on social media that are supportive of Palestine. I think we're seeing the same stuff coming from some news organizations in relation to their employees. Now, it seems to me that, yes, there is certainly a First Amendment potential challenge to those kinds of directives as well.
Any note of optimism that you can give us?
I don't know that there's much optimism at this point in the immediate future. I feel that, you know, the large numbers of people that are coming out onto the streets in the United States, the attempts to, you know, take some kind of direct action to prevent, well, the direct action, at least to highlight the different corporations that supply weapons to Israel. You know, those kind of things, I think, are incredibly valuable, crucial at the moment. The growing number of people who are contacting their elected representatives to demand that we end our unconditional support for Israel militarily and financially. I think more and more people are learning about the history here and understanding that there is another narrative to the one that they've typically only heard one side of a story before, and they're learning the other side and finding it actually to be compelling, because people understand that in a situation of military occupation, people will fight back and people will have a right to defend themselves in that situation. And I think that is something that, that increasingly is unarguable, and the Israeli side is certainly on the back foot in terms of the public debate. Whether that translates into different policies, that's the struggle that we face over the coming weeks and months and years, is to move the US from this position of complete unconditional support to a position where Israel is forced to engage in a political settlement with the other parties to the conflict.
Do you get the impression that many of the pro-Israel people sincerely believe that the Israelis just want to live in peace and the Palestinians just keep attacking them, and if they would just stop attacking, then there could be real peace in the Middle East?
I mean, I think for many people who are just ordinary people who are supportive of Israel, that's a sincerely held belief. I think for the political leadership in Israel, the position is the current status quo is perfect for them. The sort of vague rhetoric that at some point in an undefined future there might be some kind of settlement, but for now, you know, the apartheid system continues, the imprisonment in Gaza continues, the bombing continues as and when Israel feels the need to deploy it, and the settlements continue to be built. And, you know, for most Israelis, they're not living in a situation as they might have been in the past, where they might fear bombs going off in cafes and things like that. That has been the status quo up until just over a week ago, right? And so I think that status quo was attractive to the political leadership. It seemed like the Zionist project could comfortably continue on those terms. I think what's happened in the last week is that that expectation has been by actions of Hamas. And so everything's up in the air right now. I don't think the political leadership in Israel know where they're going at this point. You know, supporters of Israel in the United States, some of whom are, you know, are highly ideological, but others are just kind of, you know, expressing the things they've been brought up with, the views they've been brought up with.
Are they kind of what one Israeli writer called not so much Zionists, but Israelists? They don't really subscribe to Zionist ideology, but they just want Israel to survive, that kind of thing?
I think there's something in that. I think there's a battle going on amongst Jewish Americans right now, right? It's a battle over what it means to be Jewish in the end. And on one side of that battle is an idea that, you know, Jews will never be safe unless Israel continues to exist. And
although you could easily argue the opposite.
Well, I mean, I think the argument falls apart as soon as you examine it. But I think there are significant numbers of people who sincerely hold that argument. And you know, and I think when they're confronted with the count, you know, they basically can no longer hold on to their views, you know, in a way that would be plausible even to them. And so they have to conclude that the people making those arguments aren't serious and can only be motivated by anti-Semitism, which is why the charge of anti-Semitism becomes so central to these debates.
Anything else you want to add to what you said?
I think, you know, right now we've seen the racially motivated murder of a six-year-old in Illinois by someone who felt that, you know, that all Palestinians needed to be killed, and had a Palestinian tenant family and went in there with a knife and killed a six-year-old and injured the six-year-old's mother. I think that is the end result of the violence that we're seeing from Israel, right? Then the whole rhetoric that we're seeing from Israel. This is a moment where genocide is being openly talked about, and that is playing out in the United States in smaller ways, but ways that are real enough here as well.
That was Aaron Kunani, the author of What is Anti-Racism? And the Muslims Are Coming. He spoke with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. This has been KABU News in Depth. I'm Reed Johnson. Thank you.
To KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're nearing the end of our fall membership drive. We only have a few days left to meet our $55,000 goal, and you can do your part by going to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution today. All donations will be matched up to $14,000 thanks to a generous group of donors. KBOO's independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. Need somebody,
everybody needs somebody. When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer